This week on Writers, Inc.
I wrote the whole thing, yellow legal pad, longhand, in the restroom of the orthodontic office where I was working in Columbus, Ohio.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, I'm Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So I just read that Val Kilmer is going to be in a new movie.
Yeah.
Val Kilmer is dead.
Yeah.
Like he's... I love Val Kilmer. He's one of my favorite actors, but...
You can't stay down, you know?
I guess. Yeah, so apparently there's a movie, and like I don't have the name of it in front of me, and I probably should. He was supposed to star in it going back years and years, but he obviously had all these health issues, so it never actually got done. They filmed the movie without him, decided that they really need Val Kilmer, so they're going to put in AI Val Kilmer to basically fill the slot. I'm not quite sure how I feel about this. I think we all knew it was coming.
Well, yeah. The movie is aptly titled As Deep as the Grave. If that isn't a bang on
really,
title,
that's funny. Well, a little bit of a metafiction going on there, huh?
It's challenging. It's challenging because that part, the writer, director has come out and he was saying that the part was essentially written for Val Kilmer based on, you know, his life experience and that sort of thing. So that was the only actor he ever had in mind for that particular role. And it is an ensemble movie, so I think that implies that his part in it isn't so grand that he's on screen all the time. So we may only see glimpses of him.
They actually edited the movie without that role in it altogether, and decided that they had to put it back in. So you know the movie must work on some level without him. What I'm wondering is, you know, like Val Kilmer has always been one of those actors. He's sort of like a Robert De Niro kind of thing, where he's got a lot of like nuances, you know, facial expressions, mm-hmm. You know, these little twirks and things that are just part of him as a person, his character, that always came across in his roles. And I'm not quite sure that an AI can actually pick up on that. And reproduce it, like reproducing a voice, reproducing the visual aspect of it. I've got no doubt it can pull that off. It's probably going to look hokey. It's not going to be 100% there. You're going to know. But, you know, it's those little things. Like you watch a movie like Tombstone, like just the way that he paused, you know, in a sentence or whatever. Like how is it going to create that?
Well, you had pointed out that they had his son kind of standing in for him.
Yeah, so that's one of the rumors. So there's a Netflix, I think it's on Netflix, a special about Val Kilmer, and I think it's just called Val. And his son stepped in and did quite a bit on that because they've got a very similar voice. He looks a lot like Val Kilmer did when he was younger. So there's rumors floating around that he's going to film some of those scenes and then they're going to somehow use that to teach the AI how to act. But those are all rumors, you know, so I don't really know what the end result is.
I could see it
because
one thing that AI has proven very good at is replacing an existing character with someone else. So like, you know, Tom Cruise, you know, playing a different role or whatever. So I actually have less of a problem if it's his son and they're sort of casting over him with his father, because in that sense, it's his son playing his father, playing a role. And so it's still a human part, you know?
Well, they did something very similar with, have you guys seen the latest Indiana Jones movie, like the opening sequence?
No. Yes, unfortunately, I have seen that movie. Yeah,
So you can stop like 15 minutes into the movie. You can turn it off.
Wait a minute. Which one was that?
Oh, God, what is
that? Is that the Crystal
Dial
Skull
Destiny,
one, or was there one after
No, that's
that
not. It's Wheel of Destiny.
I haven't seen that one.
Dial of Destiny, I think.
Oh, of Destiny,
That's the one they de-aged Harrison Ford.
Yeah, so Harrison Ford is running around, you know, going after the bad guys, killing Nazis and stuff for the first 15 minutes. And it's 30-something Harrison Ford. And they did a very good job. But, you know, if you watch the, there's a bunch of documentaries now about this just showing how they did it. You know, they had to pull, like, original footage that was never used. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's, you know, obviously he's been on screen a lot, you know, so they've got a lot of material they can pull from. So when the reference material is there, it can be done. But even there, they had a stand-in, an actor that basically played the part, and then they overdubbed it visually.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Well, I was wondering, like, how long before we have a scenario where publishers decide that they're no longer going to, you know, how they do this thing with, like, Clive Cussler's new book, and it's, you know, co-authored with so-and-so who really just wrote it. You know, so how long before they switch to, you know, this author has died, we're just going to clone this person in AI and have them like enslaved to us forever, generating new books, you know, every year. That's what I think is, I think something like that's probably coming. I know a lot of authors are resisting it.
Well, it's interesting because, yeah, I didn't put this in the news this week because we talk about AI so much, but Grammarly is actually getting sued for its AI author impersonator. But that's, I mean, a bit different because obviously that's not done with the author's permission. Yeah. They're not getting paid for that. So, yeah.
Yeah. What is the author impersonator thing? What is that? I haven't heard of that.
It's an author impersonator.
I think they have like a setting on there that will say like, change your text to sound like a certain author, I think. Oh.
I actually have no problem with that. And I know,
yeah,
I'm an odd man
you're
out.
Stephen King now getting.
Well, so what? So what though? It's no different than if I practiced Stephen King's voice and I'm writing the way Stephen King wrote. You know, what difference does it make?
Well, it is though, because that would take a lot of time and a lot of practice, and not very many people would actually be able to effectively do it. But with a machine, now 30 million people could do it. And
I
so
think there are some among us in this very chat who have the ability to mimic other writers' voice.
Oh, there might be one of us at least.
Yes, it's not about one person being able to do it. It's about how, like, when a machine can do it and now 30 million people can do it, because at least if you are trying to emulate another author as a person, you know, it takes time and it takes effort, and you're going to learn something and create your own voice in the process. But people who are just like, make it sound like Stephen King, like, there's nothing there. It just spits it out. And I don't know. I think it's different. I think it's much different.
I just wrote a story for Forbes about AI, and I didn't go into this because I didn't want to. But like the general thinking behind it, and we'll keep picking on Steve. You know, you could take every Stephen King book that he's ever written, you could dump it into an AI model, basically teach it those books, but it's still not going to be able to write like him. It'll be able to sound like him. It can mimic certain things, but it's not going to be able to recreate him, because in order to recreate him, you need every life experience he's ever had. You know, like every memory, every thought, like all of that would need to be dumped into an AI model. Yeah. And even then, I don't think it could actually recreate it. So it can take, you know, like a book and say, make this sound like so-and-so, and it's going to get the grammar and punctuation and vocabulary and stuff right. But the actual idea behind it, it's not going to be able to create it. It's not going to be able to create Misery. It's not going to be able to create Christine or Pet Cemetery, like these ideas that were unique to him.
I'm very difficult to create, for sure.
Yeah. You really are. You are one of a kind.
some of those stories, I mean, if you think about it, they work so well because they were so simple. Misery, an author just getting captured by his greatest fan and held hostage, like that's a very simple idea, but you know, in the right hands, it works so well. And that's AI just can't come up with that.
Look for the next Stephen King novel, and an author gets cloned by AI and it's writing in that author's voice for eternity. It's going to make a great Stephen King book.
Thinking about what you said, though, you know, like they're already doing this. You know, Clive Cussler, V.C. Andrews has been dead for years and years and years and still putting out books every year. They may actually use AI to validate it, you know, like, because right now they've got all these books that are coming out. Now they're going to say, well, now we're using AI to actually recreate this author's voice as part of the process, which almost makes it seem more authentic than the way they're doing it now, just having a co-author step in. So they might double down on that.
If you think about it, that's not all that dissimilar to having Val Kilmer's son stand in for him and just sort of casting over him. It's the same idea. You know, the ghostwriter writes the book. They use an AI to tune it to have the same voice as Cussler or whoever.
Yeah, but if you think about it, like all these things are basically just placeholders until they figure out how to work out the kinks. Like they have to do these things in order to make it work today. You know, 5 years from now, they'll have worked that out. They're not going to need Val Kilmer's son anymore.
Right. So. Right.
Anyway, What is in the news? Hopefully not AI.
I don't like it.
Official book talk chart set to launch in the UK. Our friends across the pond are getting a book talk chart that will track the top 20 titles on the platform. Here's how it'll work. Nielsen IQ will provide sales data. TikTok will provide engagement data. And an algorithm from Media Control, which will be weighted to favor book sales over engagement, will produce the official ranking. That weighting toward sales data is the crucial detail. There's no guarantee that going viral will result in sales. There's often quite a gap between how popular a book seems online and how it actually sells. This new ranking could prove quite useful in helping industry pros in the ongoing effort to determine how much social media really matters.
Why is it so hard to say? Book talk chart.
That is really difficult for me to say.
Sounds
to book talk
chart.
It's choppy. It's like there's no. I don't know.
They need something more catchy. You can't go viral with something you can't even say.
Talk chart. That's what that would. No, that still doesn't work.
I mean, it's a very cool idea because it validates, you know, like if you're on TikTok and you follow book talk, you see a lot of books pop up and they're the flavor of the day for, you know, a couple of days or maybe a week and then they're gone. I've got no clue if they're actually selling. Then every once in a while, you've got like Sarah Moss who comes out and just completely blows up. And you know, it's across the board, you know, so this will be a nice way to validate it.
Yeah. I just want to see if there's data you can pull from this that can help you fine tune your marketing or, you know, whatever is necessary to make your book hit like that. That's what I really want to see.
Well, I mean, the truth of it, I mean, because I've used this stuff before and I've researched it. You can't just take people think that you just need a couple influencers to start talking about your book and then it gets picked up by other people and it grows. That's not how this works. Like there are companies out there that specifically pair up, you know, product sellers, and it could be any kind of product, with influencers. Those influencers get paid a cut, you know, based on the views and for promoting those particular products. So all this stuff is bought and paid for. And I'm not saying that you can't go viral with your book. I'm just saying that the game is rigged slightly and you need to make sure you understand all the parts before you actually go out there and spend money and try.
Yeah. The game is rigged, quotes J.D. Barker. All right. book output topped 4 million in 2025. U.S. book output surged past 4 million titles in 2025, driven overwhelmingly by self-publishing growth. The self-published books jumped nearly 39% to about 3.5 million, while traditionally published titles rose more modestly, about 6.6% to roughly 650,000. The longer-term shift is clear. Self-publishing is expanding much faster than traditional publishing. From 2022 to 2025, traditionally published output rose about 10%, while self-published titles grew more than 43%.
So I don't want to say those two letters again, but this has got to be AI, right?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too.
Yeah, I have to say, I mean, I think AI is definitely going to be responsible for the larger chunk of that, I'm pretty sure. But I do see a trend. There's a lot more self-publishing happening, human self-publishing happening, even over previous years. And I mean, we saw explosive growth in like 2016 to 2019 or so. And 2020, of course, was the biggest growth, but it tapered off for a while. But from what I'm hearing and seeing from insiders, it's growing again. And it's not all AI. So hopefully that's good news. I don't know. I don't know if that's good news or bad news, honestly.
I mean, it's the same thing applies, right? The cream of the crop is going to rise. So it's got to be a good book. It's got to be a book people talk about, you know, so you can churn out 100 books a day if you want, but if nobody's buying them, it's not going to matter.
Yeah. And I think that readers are desperately looking for quality books now, whereas before there was a surge of readers who just wanted quantity. You know, I want as many romance novels as I can read or as many sci-fi novels as I can read. And now that there's a glut of that stuff on the market, now they're starting to look for, you know, the higher end versions of those books. That's more gut instinct on my part than fact. I haven't seen numbers, but that's what I'm hearing from people.
Well, you can only read sort of like the same story so many times. And I know there's only so many stories out there in the world, but I think that, you know, as you pointed out in your article, JD, like they're good at recognizing, AI is good at recognizing patterns, so it'll like churn out the same, the same plot beats. But the thing is that a human writer can still make those same plot beats surprising and interesting and unexpected. Whereas, if you're just kind of going with the predictable, then it just becomes sort of very, like, now you're kind of reading the same story over and over and over again. And that gets very tedious, I think, as a reader.
Look, it's hamburger and chicken, right? Like every meal I make is composed of either hamburger or chicken, but it's dramatically different meals depending on what spices I add to it, that sort of thing. And that's what's happening is humans can take the same beats and tell a completely different story
Yeah,
and make it
right. Yeah.
sound completely original, even though it's all the same stuff, you know?
Yeah. Well, because the characters are a little bit different. You have all that different, it's different enough that it doesn't feel like the same. But when you're kind of using patterns, like, it just starts to feel like the same. And I think that's why, maybe
It's all
that's why.
hamburger helper from the AI.
Yep.
That's all it is. All right. Tracy Wolf did not plagiarize Crave series, court finds. A U.S. judge ruled that author Tracy Wolf's hit Crave, the series, did not copy another writer's unpublished fantasy manuscript. The lawsuit, first filed in 2022, argued that the works were substantially similar. It also named Wolf's literary agent, publisher Entangled Books, distributor Macmillan, and Universal, which optioned film rights. The court said the similarities, such as Vampire Academy settings, supernatural romance dynamics, and certain descriptive phrases, were basic genre tropes and common phrases which any author is allowed to use. The court selected phrases like, quote, "a shiver skitters down my spine" as evidence saying such language consists of ordinary words and common phrasing that any writer can use. The judge ultimately stated that while the books were similar in the way, quote, "all YA ro romanticy novels are similar," the decision reinforces that copyright protects unique storytelling details, not general ideas, themes, or familiar fantasy elements. Hot, sexy, dangerous boys, central to virtually all young adult romance novels, cannot be copyrighted, the court noted. And Kevin sighed in relief.
I just wanted you to read that last
I
line
know.
out loud.
Okay, see, this is where I know that you're not using AI to write stuff because you zero in on the on hard to say things and things that you're going to make me
This is
feel like
going
a
to be hilarious to hear Kevin read that. Hot,
doofus.
sexy, dangerous boys.
Hot,
Hey,
sexy,
you can't
dangerous
copyright
boys.
them. You're
The
not
Kevin
allowed.
Tomlinson story. Yeah.
That has to be my favorite thing I've ever, like, actually read in an official court document.
I mean, I don't know if you guys remember all the chaos and shenanigans around Cocky Gate. Do you remember when someone was trying to copyright the word cocky?
No.
Yeah,
Oh,
look into this. And there was also something about billionaire romance. They tried to copyright that. Another author tried to copyright any thriller cover that features a silhouette of someone holding a gun.
I remember
Oh,
that
wow.
one. They are always trying to be like, this is my original idea. And it's like, man, no, it's not. Like, a vampire romance with a broody boy in a remote dust, like, it's half of YA.
Yeah,
that's a starting point, right? That's like that's your building
yes.
block that you go from.
I actually am glad that cases like this, they're all frivolous, it's all pointless, meaningless, it's a waste of time and money. But I'm actually glad that these cases get as far as they do because the more often the courts knock these things down, the less endangered we are as writers because it only takes one idiot to get something passed through and gain copyright over something common to everybody before we're all, suffering. So I'm glad to
I
see the
agree.
courts agree with me.
That's what I was thinking about with this, is just looking at it. I've been following this case since 2022,
Yeah, for a while.
and I'm just like, man, imagine being the author that gets sued for this. I'm like, it must be so freaking awful to go through that, and you're like, you're suing me for what? Because I wrote a dark academy vampire story. I mean, yeah, so I'm very good that it's very good that the court ruled the way they did on this particular case.
I'm suing JD for the first Scarlet Dora because it infringes on my first charcuterie door idea.
Yes. Chartreuse.
Well, I've already got a cover. Door. So I win. My cover is done.
JD wins.
Yeah.
JD wins. All right. You know that manuscript you've been editing for the past year? One that's almost done, but never quite gets there? Well, right now, it's crying out for help from this episode's sponsor, AutoCrit. Quite possibly the most powerful all-in-one writing platform, AutoCrit puts an entire publishing team in the palm of your hand. Get access to customizable automated alpha and beta readers, plus series-wide story analysis, marketing support, line editing tools that can help you catch the mistakes you miss, and even more, including exclusive craft events only for members. The value is insane, and right now you can grab lifetime access for just one payment. No monthly fees, no usage limits, no caps, no tokens. At AutoCrit, unlimited means unlimited. It's time to finish your book, start making real progress, escape revision limbo, and publish with confidence story after story. Check out autocrit.com/JD to save 50% on lifetime membership right now. That's autocrit.com/JD.
All right, JD, who's up this week?
This week we've got Karen Robards on. Karen's a New York Times bestselling author of more than 50 novels. She's also won the Silver Pen Award 6 times. Her latest novel is about a young woman in the Irish Rebellion called The Moonlight Runner and releases March 24th. Here she is, Karen Robards.
So you have written more than 50 novels, which is wild to me, but what an accomplishment. You've written historical romance, contemporary romantic suspense, thriller, and you've got a new book called The Moonlight Runner. But we like to start at the beginning, since a lot of our listeners are writers. How did you get started writing? Do you remember?
Well, I've always written. I was editor of the elementary school paper when I was 9 years old. But my first book, I was in law school at the University of Kentucky, and I could see that I had a path to choose there. You know, I could go and be a lawyer, or I could try something else. So I took a graduate level creative writing course at the University of Kentucky. And the goal for the class was to write 50 pages of something publishable. Well, what's publishable? At the time, what was really being published was historical romances. And I had never really read a historical romance, because you couldn't walk into law school with, you know, historical romances. They'd laugh at you.
Yeah.
But I read a bunch of them, and I tried writing one. I loved it. So I wrote 50 pages of what I called The Pirate's Woman for that graduate level writing class. And I put everything in it. I put action and adventure and sex. Historical romance. And what the teacher didn't tell us was that we were going to have to read what we wrote out loud. So I was at till November, and the class was over in December, so it was too late to write anything else. So they got to me, and I was really proud of what I had written. I mean, it was really good. It had a little sex in it, but it was really good. Ask an impartial source. So I got up and I read it, and I read it with my best dramatic inflection. And this was a seminar, graduate level seminar, so it's all men except for one other woman and me. Mm. And they're all at this big conference table, and I'm standing up at the end of it, and I'm reading. And I got some of the spicy parts, and I'm fair skinned, so I blush. So I don't look up. I just read it. And I get to the end, and I look up, and there's this table full of very serious writers looking at me, and they don't say a word. And I think, I've wowed them. I wowed them with my deathless prose. Actually, really, that is what I thought. I was young.
Yeah.
And then I started to laugh. And they laughed and they laughed and they laughed. Oh, I was mortified. Finally, the professor, who was a published writer, stood up and he said, Karen, you're a really good writer, but we've got to do something about your choice of reading material. Well, this embarrassed me and it made me mad. And I said, you know what? You write what you write. I'll write what I write. And let's see who writes what. So I've run into it again in many, many book festivals. and we're friends. But the thing is, those that first book was actually published. Those 50 pages turned into my first book,
yeah,
which is called Violent Flying. And I've been published ever since. I am a full-time writer, and I have been for a long time, since I was 24 years old.
Yeah.
And you just, you go with the times. I mean, historical romances were hot when I started. Nobody was publishing contemporary romance, God forbid, much romantic suspense or thrillers. So you wrote what the market would bear, which was historical romance. And then the second book I wrote was a contemporary romantic thriller, which nobody was publishing then, but I didn't know enough to know that. So I wrote it. And the way I wrote it is, after Island Flame came out, that's my first book, I thought I'd be rich and famous, right? Well, I wasn't. I was not rich and famous. And I had dropped out of law school, so I had to get a job. And I got a job in an orthodontic office, because my father's an orthodontist, and one thing I knew how to do was put braces on teeth. So I'm working in this orthodontic office. My book, Island Flame, comes out. It's on the shelf 6 weeks, and it vanishes. Paperback romances, you know, they don't last long.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought, oh my God, this is all this is? And I thought, no, I'm not going to let this be all this is. And I'm working full-time, 40 hours a week, and we had an hour for lunch. So I took my lunch break, and this is my second book. I went into the restroom, the ladies' restroom of that orthodontic office, and I sat on the toilet with my yellow legal pad and my pen. And I'm sitting there thinking, I have to write another book. You know, I can't just let this die like this. And what they always tell writers is write what you know. So I'm sitting there, I can't think of anything to write. I'm thinking, what do I know? What do I know? I think, I know this restroom. Mm-hmm. I know what it smells like. I know what it looks like. So the opening scene of To Love a Man, what turned out to be To Love a Man, is set in an outhouse when the journalist, Lisa Collins, is hearing this horrific attack around her, and the whole farm in Rhodesia where she's staying is being wiped out. And so that was my second book. And that was the book that got me an agent and really got my career started, To Love a Man. I wrote the whole thing, yellow legal pad, longhand, in the restroom of the orthodontic office where I was working in Columbus, Ohio.
Yeah, I love so much about that. There is a lot to unpack there. I love that when people laughed at you, which, you know, I don't know if it happens as much now, but it used to happen a lot when I started writing, that people who were genre writing would get laughed at by people who are trying to write what they deem more serious novels, right? So, I mean, just to have the grit, and then you dropped out of law school to pursue writing? Like, was that kind of how that went?
That was how that went. Ask my parents what they thought about that. And you know the terrible thing about it? I really did. I thought I'd write a book and get rich and famous. Mm-hmm. You know how they're paying me for that first book?
No.
$625. Yeah, that's not funny. And I had already, I mean, I burned some bridges there.
Yeah.
And so there I was, and it's like, uh-oh.
Mm-hmm.
But it worked out. Would I do it again? If I knew what it was going to be, sure. At the time, I don't know if I'd be as brave now.
Yeah, that has to be so scary. I mean, you just, 6 weeks and your book is off the shelf, and you didn't have an agent at that time either.
Not at that time. I got the agent after I wrote To Love a Man. I wrote that whole book on the yellow legal pad. And mm-hmm. then I, because that was pre-computer. And I sent it to 3 agents in New York, and the second one took it.
Wow.
And there it went. Thank you, God.
Yeah. Thank you. So I'm curious, how did that first book get published without an agent? Did that just go direct to the publisher, or how did you go about getting that done? Yeah.
I had a book called The Writer's Market. And it listed all the publishers in New York. And I'm very methodical. I go like ABC. And I did look to see who published what. And I ended up, it was, I forgot what it was called then, but it ended up being Leisure Books.
Mm-hmm.
Called something else that started with a B, but I can't remember what it was. And so they published that one. And the thing about it, in that first contract, it had provisions for a sequel and a third book. So before To Love a Man could come out, I had to write two more books for them.
Wow.
Then, after writing three, which I wrote pretty fast back then, the new publisher, Warner, who bought To Love a Man, had decided I was a historical romance author by then. And To Love a Man is not a historical romance. It's a thriller, a contemporary thriller. So I had to write another historical romance for them before To Love a Man could come out.
It's a good thing you write fast. Yeah, that's a lot.
I was so excited and so happy to get the contract, even the first one. It was the thrill of a lifetime. It was back, I mean, it was before Amazon. And if the publishing houses didn't take you, you didn't get published. That was it. So I was thrilled.
Yeah. So, okay. So you wrote in the woman's restroom on your lunch hour. Did anyone ever like worry about your health?
Yes. I didn't tell anybody what I was doing. You know, it sounds stupid to say I'm going into the bathroom on my lunch hour, writing a book on the toilet.
I just wonder, nobody wondered why you're in a stall for an hour all lunch every day.
Maybe gastrointestinal problems. Yeah. In the restroom every day at lunch for the whole
time. So I'm curious, where do you write now? What does your workspace look like?
Oh, I have an office now. I have an office. Actually, I can write anywhere. I write in the car. My three sons don't live with me anymore, so I go visit them, right? We go on vacation. I write wherever I am. I don't have any trouble finding a spot. One time, my son and I were coming back from, well, actually, my son had cancer a while ago. Mm-hmm. He's fine. But we were coming back from MD Anderson, and I was on deadline. And I, you know, we were coming back and we were in a hotel room and I had to do a scene. The only place I could find in that whole place that was quiet, I went into the bathroom. I shut the door. I got into the bathtub with a pillow and I sat in the dry bathtub and wrote the last two chapters of that book. It was Sleepwalker.
Yeah. I love that. I love that you can write anywhere. That's great. So you've been doing this a while and you've been for how long? 45?
5 years. 45 years.
That's wild. So you've been called one of the most reliable thriller writers in the world by Daily Mail. So I'm curious, how can a writer be reliable? What kind of thoughts do you have about that?
You write. I mean, I started out, of course, without any children. Mm-hmm. And in terms of my life, I've had three sons and everything that goes along with having three sons. You know, you have life. You just have to write through it. When my son got cancer, I went to MD Anderson with him. We were down there for 6 months. He's fine now. Thank you, God. And
thank goodness.
But I sat by his bed, and while he was getting chemo and radiation and the whole bit, I wrote. You write. People talk about, and I'm afraid I'm going to jinx myself. People talk about getting writer's block. The key to writer's block is write anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Write. You just write. And the story I have found too, I used to try to write like a synopsis or something, but the synopsis never ends up being what the book's about. Never. I warn my publishers now, you know, I have to hand in a synopsis before and they approve it. And then guess what? The book takes an unexpected turn. I have been doing this long enough now. I relax and I know the story is there. And you just let it write. You write it. It's like, I think somebody, was it Michelangelo? I think it was Michelangelo, who said, the statue's already there in the stone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Chip away at it.
Yeah, you have to kind of relax and let it come out.
Yeah. Yeah.
I relax and tell myself a story.
That's perfect. Yeah, I think that's it. You just got to write, even when you don't feel like writing and you don't know what's, you're going to write. You write because you're a writer.
That's right. You write because you're a writer.
Yeah. So you've been doing this, like you said, 45 years. You've hit the New York Times bestseller list a few times. And I imagine you've seen a lot of changes in the publishing industry. Yeah. So, yeah, you were, like you said, contracted at one time to write two books a year, and they had to be historical and then contemporary and then historical.
Isn't that?
Yeah, what do you have a perspective on, like, everyone always worries that things are going to change and it's going to be detrimental to the industry. Do you have any, like, positive insights or thoughts, maybe that are not so positive about the publishing industry and where we may be headed?
Sure. First of all, they said that ebooks were going to wipe out
Print books.
They
Yeah.
have. They've just added another medium. They said that people being able to publish their own books would wipe out traditional publishing. It hasn't. You know what that does? It gives you freedom. Before, if you did not get in with one of the major publishers, and I think there's like five now, too bad, so sad on you. You're not going to publish your book. Now, there are alternate routes. And that's a wonderful thing for writers and for publishing. It's freeing, it takes the stress away. I personally have never gone that route yet, but it's good to know that it's there. And I know a lot of writers who do use it.
Yeah.
And as for AI, AI is funny and a joke, and it never take the place of writers. Let me tell you about AI. I like it. I mean, it's very entertaining, but it puts out a synopsis of my books all by itself. You can find it on the internet. I have nothing to do with it. I read the synopsis. That's not my book. That doesn't have anything to do with my book. Sometimes it's not even the right characters in my book. It's hilarious. What it does is it scrapes information that's there and it spews it back out. And it's not creative. It won't do it. I mean, if people want the same story over and over again, I guess you could plug in and say, write me this or that. But it's not going to take the place of writers. You don't have to worry about it.
Yeah. So, speaking of being creative, let's talk about your new book, The Moonlight Runner, which is a historical romance set in Ireland after the Great War with the Irish Rebellion. This is what, novel 50 plus. How do you choose, like, what you want to work on and get an idea that really excites you? Tell me about this book.
Well, this is The Moonlight Runner,
Yeah.
and I really love it. I had written, or I have written, I wrote three World War II books before, The Black Swan of Paris, The Girl from Guernica, and Some Murders in Berlin. And I love that time period, but I wanted to move on. And the troubles in Ireland have always interested me. I thought it was a fresh new setting. And so I got this idea. I like to do research. So I started doing research. And World War I ended basically November 11th, 1918, and so the men came home. Well, The Moonlight Runner starts on Christmas Day, 1918, about a month after World War I had ended. And so the men had come home. The men in my book had come home. They were home, and a whole new war started up. The Irish and the English were on the same side during World War II. They fought valiantly, side by side, but then they got home and friction arose. And Ireland, or most of Ireland, wanted its independence. And England said no. And this novel of mine is how they negotiated until they couldn't negotiate anymore, and war broke out between the two countries that had been on the same side. And my main character, Wren, Mary Wren Carmichael, is a nurse who is working in a convalescent hospital, an old Irish mansion that had been turned into a convalescent hospital for the World War I soldiers. And so she overhears a British general saying, "Ha ha, we've got some gun runners coming in." It was Christmas night around midnight, and she was still on duty, and she heard this. "And we've got an ambush, and we're gonna catch them." Well, she's Irish. And the men who came home, one of them was her longtime love, her childhood love, Donald O'Reilly. And his cousin's a rabble rouser. He's in the IRA, he's a rabble rouser. And she knew Seamus, the cousin, would be involved in this. And she warned Donald, no, 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 you're not going to do this, right? Because you just got home from the war and we just got engaged and you're not going to get involved in this, right? He said, nope, nope, I'm not. Well, as soon as she heard this, she thought, you know what? I know who's in this. And so terrified, if the British weren't kidding, if they caught you gun running, they were going to execute you. And they had executed a bunch of people from the Rising in 1916. And she had been there because she was doing nurses training. So she had seen all this. So she had this horrible feeling that Donald was out there in this boat bringing in bringing in guns. And she grabs a lantern and she sneaks out and she runs to the point, which is a cliff high over Donegal Bay. She's from this little village right here on Donegal Bay. And she holds up a lantern to signal them. They don't see her. She sees them coming in. So she throws the lantern down. She runs down the cliff. She runs out to warn them. In the nick of time, because the soldiers come running out and they would have been captured. So they go out and then it all goes wrong.
Yeah.
It all goes. That's the basis of any good story. It all goes wrong.
Yeah. And I really love the character you picked for her being, you know, an Irish mother and Irish identifying, but also an English father who abandoned her, which makes, you know, for some interesting loyalties. And she seems to kind of mature in her decisions and perspectives as she goes throughout the book and who she's choosing to have relationships with.
Yeah, she is hybrid. I mean, she is half, and she, I can't tell you the whole plot.
No, we don't want to spoil it.
Yeah, but she manages to wind up in England, in high society England. I mean, she dances with the Prince of Wales. She becomes the toast of the town there in England for a while. Mm-hmm. And of course, people look down on her because she's Irish, because that was the prevailing attitude. And in the end, she has to choose. She has to choose between her country, Ireland, and her adopted country, England, her father's country, and the country that she has moved to. And she has to choose between three men. Three wonderful men, basically battle-scarred men, all of whom served in World War I. And she has to choose what side she's on. And it's a very hard choice for her. And in the end, I thought it made sense. I loved her choice, and I loved what she did and how it ended up.
Yeah.
There's quite a tragedy in there somewhere, but there's a lot of good stuff, too.
Yeah, I really enjoyed reading it. And like you said, it must have been a lot of research to do. Yeah, how do you go about doing the research? Do you do it all before? Do you do it as you're writing? What does that look like for you?
I do some before. I mostly do it as I'm writing. And the worst thing about research is, the worst thing about historical fiction is it's a lot of research.
Yeah.
It's areas that I haven't really looked into before. Take, for example, boats. Now, what do I know about boats in 1918, 1919? I don't know anything about it. So, and this is me, I'm kind of perfectionistic. So I'm looking up boats. It took me 2 days to come up with the right boats. And I've tried to get them right and how much they could hold and what they're doing. The black sails, one of the characters, Owen, has a big boat called the Reaper that comes in. It has black sails. And I always thought that black sails thing wasn't true. But yeah, in World War I, they really did black out the sails because you couldn't see the boats at night.
Mm-hmm. So
even the medicine, she's a nurse. And as a writer, I have to know what my character knows so I can write about it. So I had to look up the medical treatments for different ailments at that time. And it was really interesting and eye-opening. I had a good time writing that book. It's just everything, the clothes, everything,
yeah.
the attitudes of the people toward one another. You have to look it up, and I read a lot when I'm writing, and I'm on the internet all the time, and I order books, and it's a big thing. I mean, I enjoy it a lot. Contemporary thrillers are not as research intensive.
Yeah, I was just, you know, thinking you're writing two books a year and with at least one being historical, and the type of research, you know, it could take months of research.
With historical fiction, I just do one a year.
Yeah.
I'm back into thrillers.
The nice thing about thrillers is you don't have to do as much research. Some, but not as much.
Thing. You know, I know what people eat, what they wear, all this stuff. I know that already. So that's inside me. So it just saves the background details, which are very important. You know, I know what kind of cars there are. I know what kind of fuel they take. I know these things. So I don't have to do as much research because I already know that.
Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic. Do you think you'll ever write a different genre, or do you think you're pretty much in the historical, contemporary romance and thriller?
I want to do science fiction. I've got a science fiction novel. You know, the great thing about having done this as long as I've done this, I don't feel bound by having to write a certain type of book. Mm-hmm. At some point, I have a science fiction book in my head that I want to write. And there's lots of things out there to write. And I think people are interested to read different things. I mean, I go back and forth between things all the time. I like to write. And I have stories in my head. And they won't all get out, but, you know, some of them.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. And I love science fiction. So I hope you do that.
Murderbot. Have you read the Murderbot series?
Yes, I have. I think I have one right back behind me here somewhere too. I can pull it out.
And I like The Martian.
Yeah,
I like science. I used to read Ray Bradbury.
Same. I love The Martian. I love Hail Mary. I love Ray Bradbury. This is my sci-fi fantasy bookshelf behind me. So everything back there is pretty much sci-fi fantasy, but yeah. Great. Well, fantastic. So Moonlight Runner is coming out. And just as we wrap up, I have one final question we like to ask everyone. If you could offer one piece of advice to newer or aspiring authors, what would that be?
Keep writing. Don't let rejection, don't let bad reviews, everybody gets bad reviews sometimes. Don't let, especially with the internet now, don't let get you down. The best thing you can do for yourself as a writer is believe in yourself. Believe in yourself and believe in your writing. Everybody's not going to, but you have to if you want to make it long term. You have to have a belief in the stories that you are telling.
Okay, my favorite thing about this interview is that Karen wrote on the toilet.
So I've written like at least 10 of my books were written on the toilet. I don't see anything remarkable about that.
I'm just picturing
this.
I have
not done that.
You know, I have not either.
Spending an hour in the restroom at your work. I'm like, I think all of my colleagues would be like, are you okay? Do you need a doctor?
Do you need fiber?
Did she have like post-it notes up in the stall and like notes, you know, just
wouldn't
like
that be awesome?
She had like a murder board taped to the back of the stall door.
Yeah. Like I'd have an out of order sign on the front door, you know? Yeah. Caution tape. Keep the other people out.
Oh my goodness. Hey, that's going to end up in a novel somewhere, out of order restroom with things going inside.
Well, honestly, she stole the idea from Fonzie, right? If you remember Happy Days, the bathroom was his office.
It was his office. Yeah.
Really? I do remember that now that you say that. Yeah.
I don't remember that.
My memory sucks. I don't forget anything.
No, that's that's exactly right.
So have you ever written anywhere like that unusual? What's the most unusual place you've written?
I mean, I've written in a lot of weird places. Like if I put, I listen to noise canceling headphones with a thunderstorm soundtrack. And like, if I put that sound on, I can kind of write anywhere. But I've never written in a bathroom. I mean, I've written on trains, I've written on planes, I've written on private planes. I've, you know, any place, you know, cabs, whatever, but not in a bathroom.
I've written in a lot of bathrooms.
Now that I'm writing short stories, I need to write a short story in a bathroom that takes place in a bathroom.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like I could do that in a claw tub with like a tray and some bubbles and a nice cap.
Yeah, Trumbo style.
I could do that.
Yeah.
Trumbo wrote all his stuff. Well, after a while, his back was always hurting, so he soaked in a tub. I've written in bathrooms for sure. I wrote in line for a ride at Disney World.
I mean, you're waiting a long time.
Yeah, it was like a 4-hour wait.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had plenty of time.
I heard you talk about that, so I have to ask, what ride was it?
It was Flight of Passage, the Avatar ride.
Yes.
And it was pretty new at the time. So, you know, I was surrounded by German tourists who didn't speak English. So I didn't didn't have much to do. So it worked out great. It's my top of funnel book. That's if you go to my website and sign up for my newsletter, you can get that book.
I've written in the bathtub, but that's probably as weird as I've gotten.
What are you writing on? Like on your phone or?
My phone. Yeah. Like, so like you're just like sitting there soaking and an idea comes up and you just like grab your phone and open the notepad and just start typing away. I've done that. And I guess hot tubs and pools.
Yeah. I need to be more antisocial is when I'm, you know, I've read books at little kids' birthday parties before because, so maybe I'll just start writing. Come to the social event. Okay, I'll just write.
I used to read it. My dad used to drag us to sporting events. So I used to read books. Like I am very good at tuning out sporting events and reading a book, but I don't attend those anymore. But I would probably write again on my phone if I was dragged to a sporting event because why not?
That would be hilarious. Let's get season tickets somewhere and just write a whole novel. Like
this is my writing time.
I think that would be a great gimmick though. Like if you
what a waste of hockey tickets or something.
What do you mean? I mean, I'm there. Isn't that like
you could probably get free tickets. Be like, hey,
it's just there's no. I mean, like I've spent a lot of time with like movies playing, or you know, I can't do this as easily anymore. But I used to always have like a movie or something playing while I was writing. Yeah. And so, you know, you get kind of into the zone and you don't notice the noise, but you're still present. Like you're still there. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. So from starting her career to the end, she's been in this business a long time. So it was very reassuring to hear her say that AI won't take over. It just scrapes. I guess, JD, that's the same thing you said in Forbes. So we've already talked about that.
Well, that's what it's doing now. It's coming for us, I think, eventually. But
yeah,
I don't think so. I don't think it's ever going to flat out replace human writers. I think what'll happen is there's going to be two categories of books out there. There's going to be AI and there's going to be human, and there's going to be people who don't care and will read anything, and then there's going to be people who care more about who wrote it and want their story, because our story is just as important to the reader as the story we're writing, because they want to connect with the person who wrote that book.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, because I do an author's note at the end of a lot of my books, and like that's the one part that people always talk about or ask me questions about. That's their favorite part. You know, like they like that little check-in in your life.
You know, an interesting thing, I don't know if you guys saw this or not, and I'll have to remember where I read it, but they just did a study. And I guess a reason I side with Kevin on this one, that it won't actually eventually take over writing. I don't know if they did like fMRIs or how they tested this, but there was a study they just released that said that, you know, writers who tend to use AI to write actually had a decline in their overall creativity. So their AI writing crept into their non-AI writing with enough use. And then their ability to actually like come up with like novel and creative ideas also started to decline over time. So the more they used AI to, I guess, be creative, quote unquote, the more difficult it was for them to actually be creative when they didn't want to use AI. And I thought that was actually really interesting, because I guess it supports that idea that like you'll have AI writing, but writers who sort of lean on that for their creative crutch, like they're not going to be able to keep up with like the interesting, intriguing ideas and creativity that good writing requires.
Think about how that plays out. You know, if you ask an AI to describe a room where a scene is taking place just because you want to save a little time, and it gives you a description of that room and you use that description, all of a sudden you're not pulling that from your brain anymore. So you're not exercising that writer muscle. Yeah. And that writer muscle is getting weak. So when you actually hit it up for some other detail, it's not going to be able to produce it as easily as it could before, because you're not working it.
I think it's what you said, you know, JD, you're always like, be here. And I've actually been thinking about that this week, like how, if I'm really here as standing in for one of the characters in this world, what is everything around me? And I think AI is just, you're at the surface. So you're not there.
Yeah.
You're not in the work. And I think that's the way they're,
yeah,
that it's killing creativity.
Yeah. It's like the difference between watching a travel video and being in that location.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like you know, I can describe a place based just on what I've read or what I've seen, you know, through other material, but I won't connect with it. And if I'm not connecting with it, then what I convey to the reader is two dimensional.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And if you just start kind of accepting like, oh, that's a decent description, and you kind of just keep leaning on, and, you know, yeah, it's like you just said, you forget, you stop using those muscles of how else could I describe this? What interesting way can I tie it in? And anyway, so I did think that was actually a really interesting study. I'll have to find it and I'll send it to you.
And I do think, like, in, like you said, in the descriptions, I saw a post on social media that was like, look, and, you know, this wasn't about AI in general, but it's like, I can only so many times see a character shrug or roll their eyes or smile. It's like, what is their unique way that they would react to this? And you're never going to get that from AI. Right.
No.
Yeah. So that's why all my characters shrug, smile, and nod.
Yes. Perfect.
I am so guilty in my first drafts of that, you know, like, she shrugged, he shrugged, he frowned, she frowned, like going through and fixing those in the edit.
Yeah. And to be honest and fair about it, like I have done the same, and I only know so many expressions for the way we, you know, gesture or whatever. But you can get really out of hand if you start trying to kind of invent new things. So I tend to stick close to shore, and then
I've got an emotion thorax up there somewhere. I'd highly recommend that if you don't have it, but I don't always use it, but then it gets me thinking about other ways you might react.
Yeah. What other parts of the body, or like, how can you draw it? Like, you know, not necessarily like expressions or physical gestures, but, you know, can you?
I just don't want that stuff to take over from the story. Yeah. Like I don't want it taking someone out of the story.
Oh yeah.
So it's a tough balance to strike, but I agree. I probably use the same things too often. So it's something
hashtag
to look out
first
for.
First draft problems.
Yeah, that's right.
As long as you're not writing about a breath they didn't know they were holding, because you will get lambasted.
Oh, come on.
Pardon me. I just had a breath I didn't know I was holding just seconds ago. So
can we shout out the, what is it? Psychological thriller readers.
Yeah.
They always learn. They do screenshots of that phrase in all the books and put them up in their Facebook
group. It's prolific in YA. Isn't that where it started, was YA?
Probably. Yeah. Maybe we should take that to court. Anyway, JD, who's up next week?
Next week, we've got Steve Barry coming on. Steve is the New York Times and number one international bestselling author of 19 Cotton Malone novels, 6 standalone thrillers, 2 Luke Daniel adventures, and several works of short fiction. He has over 26 million books in print, translated into 41 languages. He's also one of the founding members of ITW. He's going to be here to tell us about his latest book, The Devil's Bible, which just released. Steve Barry.
Sounds great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode, and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.